Cheryl Thorne, Reel 5. You were telling me that you went to conduct a search alongside the Enniskillens.
That's right. What also actually happened is that we would attach to the Enniskillens because Tom Augusta was creating a bit of a problem, and the Enniskillens were there. It's quite a large port, Tom Augusta, and there's a Turkish and a Greek community there. And I have vivid memories of working with the Enniskillens, and particularly, and that's the first time I was affected by terrorist action because a bomb was thrown into the back of my vehicle. And typical young platoon commander, what did I do? But I dived for it and flung it out of the vehicle, which was probably a damn silly thing to do.
What should you have done?
Well, I think in that case, in fact, there weren't soldiers in the vehicle. The only real risk was to the vehicle. And I think, and the driver, who was actually out of the vehicle, because the vehicle was stationary. So I think I should have left it there. But instead of which, I went and made sure the vehicle wasn't damaged when I could have actually been killed. So it wasn't actually all that intelligent a thing to do, but it was sort of an instinctive reaction.
What kind of vehicle was it? Was it a...
It was a Land Rover.
So it was your personal vehicle?
It was the Tomb Land Rover.
The Tomb Land Rover. Did you see who threw the bomb?
No. We all rushed around vigorously.
What sort of bomb was it?
It was a canister with explosives in it and a fuse. In the event it never went off.
Didn't
go off. Maybe that's because it was flung with some vigour by me and perhaps it sort of deserved the fuse. We really imposed the curfew with the Enniskillens for about 2 weeks, I think it was, at least two weeks. And one saw then the kind of animosities that you can create if you impose curfews, and then you, in a sense, to keep everyone happy, your great game is catching people opening their doors or going off down the loo at the bottom of a gun or whatever. There's an element of imbalance which you can soon fall into unless you're damn careful. And there was a bit of an element of that, and I learned a lot from it. Basically, you can impose a curfew perfectly well and courteously but very firmly, and people understand. The moment you start to, in a sense, go over the top on that, then you create enemies very, very quickly. So it's quite a very real discipline when imposing curfews. And it should be done in support of the police, preferably. And in this case, in Tom Augusta, there wasn't the police, or there was, but they were very largely the riot police, who were pretty tough, and some of them, the officers had come from all over the world, where they'd been helping the British to retreat from empire in all kinds of spots. They're extremely experienced people. Some of them have just come from, one of them certainly come from Kenya, where they'd done really well. But they were tough. And they had Turkish paramilitary, as I recall, paramilitary police who worked with them and who, again, were pretty ruthless. So you've got an environment which encouraged the Greek Cypriots to be quite resentful quite quickly. And but for the firm hand that General Ian Freeland had on his battalion, and it was very firm, in a sense, the situation could have deteriorated there rather than stabilised, and nearly stabilised because of his influence. So whatever rioting there had been was under control by the time they got there. And basically we were curfewing and on the lookout for just the sort of thing that happened with this bomb.
How many troops were there then in Famagusta as a whole?
Famagusta, there was a full battalion of the Enniskillens plus ourselves. Yeah. And I presume, I didn't see them, there were one or two police and one or two others. But so you're talking about...
Five companies of
infantry? Yeah, about... probably 700, 800 soldiers, 700 certainly. Because the battalion then were a good sort of 650, 700. And then you want an extra company, which would be 120 or so. So you're talking about just under 1,000.
What was the population of Famagusta?
Oh, I don't know, but it must be 7,000.
And you, you had, there was an adequate force to enforce.
Well, when you get the paramilitary police as well. Mm.
How many of them were there, do you think?
I just don't know, Tinker Miller. You saw it in the street.
Yeah. What were the terms of the curfew then? When did the population have to be indoors?
Curfew was from 6 o'clock, as I recall. That's what time of the evening. Because as you know, it gets dark very quickly in the Near East, Middle East. And by 6 o'clock, I'm pretty sure it's 6 o'clock, they had to be inside their houses. And then curfew them until the following morning, the first thing. When you came to dawn, light up, you can go to work, and so on. So that, you know, it was a 6 till 6 curfew, 12 hour curfew.
What did your platoon actually have to do as enforcement?
It had to enforce the curfew by either on foot or in vehicle, patrolling the streets once the curfew had been imposed, and we had an area of Famagusta.
Yes.
To control. And so, you know, it was quite sort of methodical. And quite, you know, in a sense, quite simple. What you had to do, the real problem would come if people started to climb out and create difficulties. And then you had on call, obviously, the battalion reserve, released by the commanding officer, once the situation started to evolve. So, in a sense, we were the outposts, we were patrolling the streets. We were actually arresting people on occasion for being out in the streets. Very seldom, but occasionally. But on the whole, the weak civil population understood the rules of the game. Which basically, you were inside, and then you were arrested, and then it became a bit of a ball because you went to the police station, and they were looking at you quite closely.
How big was the area you were supposed to control?
I can't really recall. Mm. If I said to you a platoon, it was probably 5 or 6 streets. Mm. Probably, you know, an area which might have been half a mile square. Mm. And I would think you're talking of Famagusta of... I would think... I'm just guessing, absolutely, but 4 or 5 square miles. Mm.
Was it a residential area?
Or it was residential.
But were you in the same area the whole time you were there?
On the whole, yes. On the basis that you got to know it. And you knew all the wrinkles and, you know, how to get over the walls, where people tended to, if they wanted to sort of slip around, where they did. So you wait there.
How big would a patrol be? If you were sending out a foot patrol, how many men would you put in
it?
Section.
We weren't into the sort of the more sophisticated or regular army's approach of in Ulster, four-man patrols, working as, you know, as units, very much section. So we'll talk about it then. Mm.
But and how frequently would they actually go out on a patrol during the night? Would they be out all night, or would they be in and out?
No, two sections out, one patrol, one section in, and then we'd stagger them. Mm. So that you always had two sections out, one in, through the night. It's rather like a little guard roster.
Yes.
Same sort of thing. Each section with a radio, and with the platoon commander, with his Land Rover vehicle, which he'd drive and park, and that's why it became a target, because Land Rover is a very sort of attractive target.
Visible thing.
Yeah, and blow up a Land Rover is extremely interesting, a bit of triumph. Yeah. And this was a churchyard, actually. It was part of the churchyard.
Did you have a sort of a patrol base, a platoon base, where you were living?
No, we had, as I recall, certainly part of the time was a police station.
Mm, yes.
And in fact, I can't remember anything other than the police station.
And you were living in the police station?
Well, no, we just moved into the police station at about 5 o'clock in the evening. Mm. And moved back into the camp. Came there. I can remember the tents in the camp, overlooking the beach and the sea. They're beautiful. It was actually a very good time of year in Cyprus, October. It was October, November. probably mid-November. Late November. Very, very good time, because it was not all that hot, and the weather was fine. You weren't getting the sort of the spring rain or anything like that.
Did you plan your own patrol program, or was it directed or supervised from company headquarters?
It was directed by company headquarters. And the guy we had commanding the company was called Andrew Attill, who was a very experienced World War II soldier who'd actually spent his war in the latter part in Somaliland. So he'd been I think he'd been involved in the Somaliland scouts. He's still alive. He lives up in Norfolk. Very robust character who the soldiers learnt more about the state of the brothels in Beirut and from him than probably they'd learned from anybody. His description of that was sort of meant to frighten but also entertain. He's not afraid of mixing his metaphors, so to speak, and getting a grip of people. But he was also had an animal shrewdness about him, about when trouble might happen. He got a very good nose for trouble, very good nose for ground. So he was a real countryman, but also he was a very shrewd analyzer of the people. He was a good company commander to start with, although he was no great performer as an officer in peacetime army. He'd been very good in a wartime situation. He's a classic case of ideal man. He's very good up in Norfolk. You know, he really knows about the birds and the wildlife. He's got a very good nose for. If he'd been a poacher, he'd have been a bloody good one. That's the sort of character.
Well, if he'd been a really good poacher, you wouldn't have known.
You wouldn't have known, exactly. But like all good poachers, they become good gamekeepers, and they know the form. That was an ilk of man, and so when we went to Farm Augusta with him, it was a good combination. And General Ian Freeland, commanding the Enniskillens, he knew Andrew of old, so again, it's quite a useful sort of partnership.
Did you have an opportunity to get to know the Enniskillens while you were there, or were you too busy?
Not enough time, and they seemed to me to be very regimental, and with a very good RSM, and of course with General Ian Freeland, an outstanding commanding officer.
Did they have a different style of doing things from your battalion from your soldiers?
And I think Royal Norfolk always had a sort of thing. We're regimental, but we're not always stamping our feet. I got the impression in the Skillens, they were having something like a parade groundwork as well as getting out of it. And I felt they were very smart regiment. Under General Bob Tanner Kane, who was the precursor to Bill Wilson, we would have been a match for anybody. Under Colonel Bill Brinkley, who was a lovely, benevolent man, we were not nearly so sharp. That tells one the importance. The commanding officer's got to be on top of his battalion, really able to lead them, and a powerful influence. Colonel Bill Brinkley had enormous loyalty from his men, but he was not an incisive commanding officer. General Ian Freeland was, and you could sense it in the battalion.
You mentioned that you did make some arrests in Famagusta. Did you have any serious incidents of trouble in your platoon area?
No. In a sense, we were looking for trouble and couldn't find it.
Ah, disappointing.
Other than the bomb in the back of the vehicle. Yeah, we thought we'd been dead in that down at that station. They just arrived. What were we here for? Yeah, everyone seems to be obeying what we want them to do.
What did the soldiers make of this duty? I mean, did they take to it and enjoy it, or did they find it boring after a while? How did they get on?
I think National Service into Cyprus, involved with the Sea of Hate, as it was called, and this chap Septim Delmar,
Yes.
Referring to it very dramatically as I'm pouring the sea of hate in Cyprus, which is slightly over the top, but it was very, I mean, the church was, church and the educational society in Cyprus were after Enosis, after freedom. And so, where the real trouble came from, as they always do, but from the Young Turks, so to speak, Young Turks, young leaders, and the students. That's where the real problem potentially lay, together with the hardcore of really pretty able terrorists under George Grievous, who did a smashing job. And, as always with the British Army, he became known as Uncle George. Not some fearsome enemy, but some we always looked on with a certain amount of respect, and one day we'd catch him, so to speak. But typically British.
Did you have a list of suspects you were supposed to be keeping your eyes open for?
To begin with, not really. Later, yes, very much so. When we moved out of Nicosia to Limassol and joined 3 Commando Brigade, then very much so. The commandos were very professional.
What happened then at Famagusta? You did your curfew enforcement, and I think you said you were there for about a fortnight. And what happened after that? Did you go back to the camp of Nicosia?
We went back to Nicosia.
Yes.
Spent Christmas there. At that stage, I went off to do a signal course. Mm-hmm. I'm a signal officer. Came back in February.
Where did you do the signals course? Was that in back in the UK?
At
Hythe, yes.
So I'm back there again. Mm. Yep. And
What did you learn on the signals course?
Laying line, using the various sets for time, which were the sort of A31, I think, the A19, A62, line laying in all its glory, Morse code, I was pretty bad at that, got by, setting up command posts. It was a very good course. It was seen as one of the hardest subaltern scores, yet subaltern captain, of course, in the infantry.
Did you volunteer to go on it, or were you sent?
I was sent. I'm delighted I was. Because I saw the battalion then for the next 2 years from the eyes, with the eyes of the commanding officer, and the commanding officer who wasn't doing it strong, and an adjutant who wasn't doing it strong, so I obtained a powerful, obtained a considerable influence, and also saw how things went wrong. And when occasionally they went right, and they did quite often, then you understood why and who'd influenced it.
Sounds like an apprenticeship for command.
Very, very much so. The way I think signal officer is a better apprenticeship for command probably than adjutant.
Why would that be? Would it be because the adjutant is too busy?
Because you see them in the field.
Ah, yes.
And the adjutant adjutant is responsible for the management of battalion quarters and the administration of the battalion and the order of it. Mm. The signal officer is constantly creating the lines of communication which will make the battalion work effectively. And he's got to be able to set up the main communication from the battalion quarters, and then shift and set it up again. He's got to know why, he's got to think ahead, he's got to have a lot, he has some of the best and most intelligent soldiers in the town with him. And one of them rang me today, literally. One of my platoon rang me today, a chap called John Brister, who did very well in my shooting after I had in my signal platoon, my platoon sergeant eventually, Charles Wharton, was I think chairman of the marketing board and those other things, he and I got on extremely well. Anyhow, you've got some of the best soldiers, and there's a certain standard setting in battalion battalion organisations. Signal platoon is one of them.
When you were on the course at Hythe, Did it? What was the course primarily concerned with the technical aspects of signalling or with the operational side of it?
It was both. You've got to master the equipment. Mm. You've got to be really good at that. I loved these radio sets, the A62 and the A19. By the time I finished Signals in Cyprus, and I then went on to be Signals in Pakistan, but I used to know each set intimately and which vowel would normally go wrong, and I became a form of amateur mechanic, but I really knew those sets. Now that's in the course at Hyde, they taught you at least some of that, and then you learnt the rest when you got there. So you had to reach a certain standard in terms of your voice procedure, in terms of your equipment handling, maintenance, and then the whole of the command and control process.
Setting up the net.
Setting up the net, setting up battalion quarters in the field, the attack, the main quarters and so on, understanding exactly how that happened, how it should happen, all that. So it's tactical as well as technical.
At that time, was the emphasis upon the use of wireless communication or line?
It was probably marginally on wireless radio. But line was very important. Absolutely. I learned a lot about the equipment side too, in terms of the quartermastering side of it. And I have this happy memory of when Suez came and we were in Limassol. We had some quite interesting times, by the way, down there. Let's pick this one up. Just as an illustration of the British Army as it really is. The engineers next door to us had a putted camp, and they were sort of garrison troops for the island. They weren't sort of temporarily allotted.
You were on emergency tour then, and they were on
tour
permanent.
The tents themselves were rocking. We had duck boards, and we had a tent, and we had a sort of tin hut for mess. It was extremely basic, but we were very happy because we were very busy. And as a signal officer, we had our communications in the camp, and then of course we had all the communications out in the field. The communication in the camp included line.
Yeah.
And the next door camp was much better fitted out than mine. They were sent to Suez, and we moved into their camp. When we moved back to our camp, when they came back from Suez, we reeled in all that took it in there, and God Almighty. But anyhow, we came back from Cyprus, because, and I was pretty keen to do my way, I really looked after our kit, I really loved it. We came back with a lot of bucksy kit to Germany, which we sort of saw us through good times and bad. That's the digression.
So you went and did the signals course, and then you went back to Limassol. When you got back, presumably then you took over signals platoon.
Correct.
How many men did you have in the signals platoon, and how was it organised?
Right, well, you've got your little headquarters, which is the platoon, the signals platoon commander, and in that one is a radio operator and two sergeants, a line sergeant. We had a warrant officer, a line sergeant, and a radio sergeant, I think it was. My memory is better. But broadly, we had those two lines, right, of the line and the radio, the two parts of the platoon, and a small little coordinating headquarters in terms of the platoon commander and his sergeants and his warrant officer, who organized the whole. And we were as keen as mustard, and and for instance, when it came to, we talked about nuclear trenches back in, when we had a spare moment there, more than never to the board, I made them dig right beside us, the command post, nuclear style, in the Cyprus stone and there, so that everyone in the platoon knew how to do this. So when we were going to go to Germany, we'd know how to do it. What if you look like a ton? No other platoon in the battalion of doing that sort of thing.
How many chaps did you have altogether then in your in the platoon? Yes.
Well,
how many signallers?
Talking about between 30 and 40.
Because I'm presuming that you'd have small detachments out to company.
Absolutely.
And your major element at headquarters.
Company detachments, and then line detachments and so on. And you carry an element of maintenance in that, you know, sort of small. You had a stormman, you had you know, a corporal level stormman and lance corporal pilot level stormman, and they were much linked with the repairs people down the line in Mosul and further off in Nicosia.
Did you have wireless down to section level at that time, or did it stop at platoon?
Platoon, except where you want to have something special.
Yeah. So how many stations would that give you if you were running a battalion net?
Well, the platoons had their own radios.
Yes.
So it would be... probably about 10, up to 10. Because the commanding officer is battalion quarters. It's four companies, that's six. It's the rear echelons, if you were out in the field, and sometimes we were up in Trudos and so on and so forth, you need to communicate back down. We ran skywave aerials so that we could talk throughout the island through skywave. Indeed, we could communicate with states straight to Gibraltar sometimes. Extraordinary. Not that we needed to, but it was quite entertaining, so I picked up the stuff. So I think we're talking about 10. Of which usually you had four or five out at any one time, and sometimes you pulled the whole lot and the guy, sometimes you'd be called out to do something, and it would be the large part of the battalion. Another time, for instance, we had a major operation trying to capture Grievous up on the mountains. We just ran on a large company up there. Together with one of the commanders, so we sent up a large company of support commanders. A chap called Colonel Taylor was the commanding officer at that time, one of the commanders. And there was a terrible fire which killed five or six of our soldiers and 17 or 18 of the Gordons.
Well, what, was this a forest fire?
It was a forest fire, created while we were up there trying to capture crews. And I'd been up with one of the companies, which is rather unconventional for a signal officer, but the commanding officer. I think it's fair to say I had the confidence of the commanding officer. They knew I got a very efficient platoon. They knew they could run like clockwork. I'm extremely sort of intelligent and jacked up. And so in this case, he sent me up as second in command of this company because it was a pretty important operation. Once we had finished our stint, which was about a week up on the cordon, we were ordered down, and the next company went up. And after about 3 days, this fire occurred. And then I was sent up with the ambulances for all for the Gordons and for, and had to go right round our Paphos. And once again, it was because basically I knew the commanding officers, I can look back now, I know the commanders are confident I would get them there. I'd been up already, but it was a different route, you know. And it was very interesting meeting up with our company, which was in a state of shock, definitely. It had had a terrible flight, lots of six soldiers killed. The doctor who was up there at the time, Stan Sutton, had done a tremendous job and got an MBE for it. The Gordons went on to see with the network analysis. They had gotten themselves together much better than our company.
Have you any idea why?
Oh, yes, because the company commander and the company sergeant major were stronger personalities than ones in the company that went on over.
It's just the power of personality.
Yeah. Absolutely, and they lost 17 or 18.
Was this the largest loss of life?